the decisions are not as scary as they build them up to be. I mean, what do I know about being a journalist? Nothing. You might surprise yourself if you take the risk and take the chance, and you will absolutely 100%, I think, looking back, regret it if you don't.
And that was Misha Zielinski, Fulbright scholar, lawyer, war correspondent, and author. And you're listening to the Influence Unlocked podcast. Welcome back to the Influence Unlocked podcast. And I'm your host, Samantha Dyback, the founder and CEO of the PR Hub. This is a podcast dedicated to taking you behind the scenes of what it takes to really grow a brand, get an insight into the world of public relations, and show you how to harness your own power of influence. Whether you're looking to kickstart your own personal brand, want to learn more about what goes into building a great business, develop your leadership skills, or simply find inspiration for your own success, then you're in the right place. Join me in conversation with some of Australia's brightest entrepreneurs, industry leaders, and change makers as we go beyond the news headlines and highlight reels to explore the highs and lows of their journeys and understand what makes them tick. Get ready to unlock your influence. Welcome back to the Influence Unlocked podcast. Today in studio, I am chatting with Misha Zielinski, whose family also immigrated to Australia from Ukraine some years ago. He initially started his career as a lawyer, and his interest in storytelling and the rise of authoritarianism saw him then move on to become an established senior political figure as the leader of the Australian Workers' Union for 12 years, alongside being a contributor to MSNBC, BBC and ABC, as well as a regular columnist for the Australian Financial Review, writing on the future of democracy, Australian domestic policy, national security and geopolitics. Since the war started in Ukraine in February 2022, Misha has spent a fair amount of time covering Russia's invasion from inside Ukraine as a war correspondent for the Australian Financial Review, and a result has been personally sanctioned by the Putin regime. Inspired by his time in Ukraine, he's also recently just launched his book, The Sun Will Rise. And to add to that, he's also a director of Australian Super and the host of popular foreign policy podcast, Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. I got through the tongue twister. Misha, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you. Popular might be stretching it. Probably not as popular as your show. Foreign policy is not that popular, but great to be here.
All right. Well, I reckon we're going to have a different kind of chinwag today. Actually, I know it's going to be a different kind of chinwag. Let's kick off with my first question, which I love to ask everybody on the show. What is your one word for today and why?
My word for the day is push. Now, what does that mean? I just realised that we're basically at Christmas time, and if you're anything like me, you had a very long list of things you're going to get done on 1 January by 31 December, and my list is, I'm going to be generous to myself, semi-complete. So I've got to try to get as much done, so I'm going to try to push the end of the year and get as much of that out the door.
That's a nice one. I quite like that. I think a lot of our listeners will be feeling the same, actually. So, yeah,
don't feel too guilty. We're all guilty of it. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Now, before we sort of talk about what you're up to now, I want you to take me back to when you were 15 years old. Imagine 15-year-old Misha catching up with him today. Would he be surprised at where you are?
But man, you got old. But I guess I'd be pleased I still have my hair. That's something. There's the one thing to cling to at my age. Surprised? You know, I think so. I mean, like when I look back at my career, things only make sense looking backward, not forward, right? It seems like it doesn't necessarily all fit together. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But I think if I said I just got back from Ukraine, that would just seem just wild, particularly that there's a war and all manner of things. So I think it's surprised, but hopefully proud. It's hard to impress 15-year-old kids, and I was certainly a bit of a brat. So I imagine that... not much would have impressed me back then. So you're not rich and famous. Come on, mate. So, you know.
Well, we might actually expand on that a little bit with the next question. I'd love you to take me through what you consider to be the three, and I know it's only three, but three most definitive moments that have shaped who you are today.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I thought about this. I'm going to cheat a little bit on the first one, only because I'm going to put them together. And it's really... being born and raised in Wollongong, but also being raised by a single mother. My parents divorced when I was quite young, when I was six. And so when I look back at the things that I've done, but also I guess the things that drive me, my values, you know, I'm just so indelibly shaped by having grown up in Wollongong. And when you're growing up, you don't realise that your home is not, you know, you think the world is going to very much resemble what your hometown is like. But, you know, I grew up in a working class steel town, migrants, but Wollongong is, you know, very blue collar. It's coastal, but it's a steel town fundamentally. And, you know, as I traveled around the world, I've come to realize that steel towns in many ways are all the same and they have a particular kind of ethos about them. They're tough places, they're no-nonsense places, they're very egalitarian. And so that, along with growing up, obviously with my mum and my parents being divorced, I think that kind of made me understand that life can be tough, but that, you know, you need to stick together and look after one another. And so that's probably the big thing at the beginning. The next big one after that would be my decision to leave the law. So you touched on it at the beginning there when you're reading out my rather random CV, as I describe it.
I didn't say random.
Well, it's my word, I can say it. But I was a lawyer for the Aboriginal Legal Service. I made the decision to, I guess for want of a better term, abandon my legal career and pursue a career in laborism, so labor unions. And again, that's the values that I grew up in. You know, apart from being a steel town, Wollongong is very much a union town. And so I went on to work in labor unions, but labor politics. And so I had the opportunity, funnily enough, to represent thousands and thousands of steelworkers around Australia, but obviously in Wollongong in my career. So that was a big shift in my career and really major change in where, I guess, my career was headed. A lot of my mates that I worked with at the ALS are now barristers. And going back to my 15-year-old self, probably richer and more famous than I am, so I've done very well, but I certainly don't regret it, but a big change. And then probably lastly and most relevantly in recent times is the decision to go to Ukraine. I'm not a journalist by trade, and so I found myself there at very short notice. I flew to Ukraine having never been a journalist, so I'd written for newspapers on the 16th of February of 2022. The war started a week later. So how do you become a war correspondent? You spend 20 years in a newsroom grinding it out, hoping for a great posting. Or you just turn up and correspond from a war zone, which is what I did. So I guess those three things are pretty large markers. And when you look backwards, it kind of makes some level of sense. But, you know, all were big pivot points, I guess, in my life.
We're going to go through, I want to delve into those a little bit more. Let's sort of touch on that switch from being a lawyer to basically going into politics and leading the Australian Workers Union. I know you sort of joked about like some of your friends now being barristers,
right.
But like when you reflect on making that change, how do you feel about making a big career switch?
Well, I think ultimately you got to do what your gut tells you to do. So I think a lot of people, one of my favorite quotes is that don't die with the music in you. It's a Wayne Bennett quote, right? And he cites it, says too many people die with the music in them.
Have you read that book?
It's a great book.
It's a great book. I've recently read it.
Fantastic, yeah. And so ultimately, whilst I enjoyed the law and whilst what I was doing was very important, you know, obviously with the Indigenous justice issues and it clearly for the person that's being charged with a criminal offence, there's nothing more important for that individual. But I'm someone that's driven by impact and trying to make the biggest difference possible to the things that I care about. And so unionism was an avenue for that. So I think to be a really great lawyer, you got to love the law. And I didn't love the law, and I knew that. And so it was better to make the choice quickly and earlier in my career, which is what I did. It was a big decision, and a lot of people thought I was nuts. But, you know, it was one that I certainly don't regret because it was where I wanted to be more naturally, where I spent my time thinking, what I was interested in reading about, what I was interested in debating and pursuing. And so I was like, well, if you can align, you know, what you care about with someone prepared to pay you to do it, then that's the kind of best result if you can manage that. Not a lot of money, you know, join the union movement for the cash or the glamour and the prestige, but you do it for the meaningfulness of it, and I certainly don't regret that.
Yeah, and I'm sure if it's when we were chatting a few weeks ago or maybe I've read this, but everything that you've done to date and from everything that I've heard you talk about, it seems like you're very much about fairness and freedom in everything that you do.
Yeah, they are, I guess, the two values that drive me the most, fairness and freedom. So fairness, egalitarianism, having grown up in Wollongong. Now, a lot of people associate fairness with equality, not necessarily the same thing. They're related. Fair is hard day's work for a fair day's pay. You know, what is fair? It's about what is about right for someone having put in the effort for it. So work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people are working hard, playing by the rules and not getting ahead, certainly at the moment. And that's something that built Australia, that principle. And it's one that is very, very dear to my heart. My family benefited from that enormously when we moved here after World War II. And It's what, you know, the AWU we would fight for every day. And so in terms of freedom, well, you know, that goes without saying. But it's one of those things that, what is freedom? It's one of those things you only know it when it's gone, right? And until your freedom is deprived from you, until you no longer able to do the things you want to do or express yourself in the way you want to express yourself, then suddenly you feel the oppressiveness of that lack of freedom. But it's something that people take for granted because it's not visible. You can't necessarily price it, and it can slip away from you very suddenly, but also very slowly. And so they're the two things that, if I stream them together into a coherent narrative or position of my values, that they'd be the two that sit together, yeah.
That word freedom, I think, would definitely touch on that. You were saying, I love that you said, you know, you don't recognize that you don't have it until right. it slips away, which you've seen a lot of that, no doubt, being right. in Ukraine over the yeah. past nearly 2 years. But sort of coming back to that idea of going from lawyer to being a unionist, there's a lot of people who think about switching careers and maybe they don't think they'll have that freedom, or that they don't have that mindset that they will be, that they can be free if they switch careers. They're too scared. What's a practical piece of advice that you could give anyone listening who's sort of sitting there but not sure how to make that leap?
It's going to sound very trite, but I mean, just jump, right? It's not as scary as you think, I think, is them. And decisions aren't irreversible. So if you're good at what you do and you're already doing it, you feel established, but you're not quite happy with it, if you make a choice to jump out and maybe it's a sideways move, there could be an element of risk associated with that. But you can always go back, right? I mean, no decision. People sort of treat their lives as this kind of irreversible decision-making process. They're like, I've gone through this gate and that gate's shut and I can't keep going. Now, of course, there are moments that are unique moments that you can only take at certain moments. And I talked about that with Ukraine, et cetera. But broadly speaking, most people's careers are, the decisions are not as scary as they build them up to be. And you might surprise yourself. I mean, what do I know about being a journalist? Nothing, right? And people might still say that, right? Before you jump in, listeners at home, he still doesn't know anything about journalism. But you might surprise yourself if you take the risk and take the chance, and you will absolutely 100%, I think, looking back, regret it if you don't. And I think if you already are feeling it, it's unlikely to go away. That the gut knows, I think.
Is that how you were feeling at the time when you were thinking of when you went from lawyer to union?
Yeah, it was how I spent my free time. I would spend my time either talking about politics or talking about the issues underpinning politics, like housing affordability or wages. I did economics at university as well, so reading economics policy. And I was like, I'm not spending all my time or free time or after hours time reading about the law. And I think to be really great at something, you really got to be quite obsessed with it. And so if you're lucky enough to be able to align your passion with your purpose, with what's economically viable for you, then that's the way to do it. Also, I think it gets harder and harder to make these decisions the further and further you are into adulthood, I suppose. Like, you get a mortgage, you get a partner or a spouse, you have children, you have debts, you're getting older, you feel that there's more difficult. So I'd say it's jump sooner, because every day you didn't do it, is a day you haven't done it. And yeah, it's a Chinese proverb, but you know, when's the best time to have planted a tree? 20 years ago. When's the next best time? Today, right? And so I think, but it's just the courage to do what you already deep down want to do. Coming back to what we're talking about, you know, the Bennettism, you know, don't die with the music in you, right?
Let's talk about the courage to do something that you want to do, because you went and did that again at the beginning of last year. You said you weren't a journalist, but somehow you end up being a war correspondent going to the middle of a war zone in Ukraine. Tell me about that.
Well, so I'd been in the United States doing my Fulbright scholarship, looking at the rise of authoritarianism. So what I call the Dictators Club, this group of regimes that are very hostile to our way of life. We're talking about freedom, so hostile to how we live our lives here in Australia or in other democracies around the world. Not just they don't like them, they are openly hostile to our societies. And so I was studying that. It's a matter of public record, but I came back to contest a pre-selection, was unsuccessful in that, so I obviously wanted to go into federal parliament for Labor. Didn't get there.
Where was that? What seat?
In Cunningham. So that's seat of Cunningham, Wollongong, my hometown, where I was born, raised, and lived for a very long time. And so I was like, what am I going to do with my life, I guess? And so was watching with interest and concern what was happening in Ukraine. And I'm a Russian speaker. Clearly had an interest in these questions around foreign policy, the rise of authoritarianism, you know, conflict, et cetera. And I'd been writing for the Australian Financial Review, not formally, but I was writing columns for them and opinion pieces. So I rang up the editor of the Fin, Michael Stutchbury. I said, mate, watching what's happening in Ukraine. What do you think about me going over? I said, well, if you're crazy enough to go, feel free to go and you'll be our guy there. And Stutch was good enough to, he said he couldn't guarantee me anything other than one long piece a week and said, but if things kick off, then you'll be our man on the ground. And I guess the rest is history. So I landed in Ukraine a week before the war started. And, you know, so I saw how it was and everything since then. But I'll never forget basically when I got on the plane, I was like, okay, well, it seems like it's almost, it's like exciting maybe, but almost academic or abstract. And then when I landed, the first thing I saw on my phone was it said that the headline was Vladimir Putin to test nuclear weapons in Black Sea this weekend. I thought, bloody hell, what have I done to myself? You know, and so you can talk about these things as we sit here now in Sydney, long way away. But when you are there, it certainly sharpens the mind as to what the risks of the situation were. And so it was a massive privilege to have done what I've done in terms of telling the stories of Ukrainians and their bravery. But looking back at it's probably not, when I say change your career, I don't necessarily mean go to Ukraine or go to Gaza or anything like that. But the more you hesitate, the more you miss the opportunity. So I didn't hesitate. I had the unique moment in time where I felt like I was a person who could make a contribution in that space. So I went.
So what happens next? You get there, you don't go, oh shit, I've done the wrong thing and jump on a plane and come home. The war breaks out officially a week later.
Yeah.
What happens?
Well, so the Russian army was obviously on its way. So I woke up to missile sirens and explosions. Now, I'd never heard either a missile explosion or a siren in my entire life. So it was obviously quite a shocking feeling. Now, we knew it was coming, but even though you knew it was coming, nothing quite prepares you. So I think I'd only had about an hour or two of sleep. And so I've woken up and my phone's in meltdown. You know, everyone's like, have you seen this? I'm like, have I seen it? Well, yeah, I'm looking at it, right? But the thing I remember most was two things. One was I couldn't find my boots in my hotel room. And I think it was just because my head was in a bit of a spin. Mm-hmm. So I was just walking around my room and the boots were obviously like right in the middle of the room. But for whatever reason, I couldn't see them because I was just overloaded with thoughts and shock. And then also the Russian army were up in the northern border of Ukraine is Belarus. The Russian army was stationed there. So that's about 300 or 400 kilometers from Kyiv. So Sydney to Canberra, give or take. And so I'm kind of looking at the updates in there across the border. It's 300 kilometers, 200 kilometers, 100 kilometers, 50 kilometers. So the Russians end up 5 kilometers from my hotel, and the Ukrainians, God bless them, kept them out over the next few days, a week before I left Kyiv. So it was a very surreal experience more than anything. But I remember speaking to the editor, Michael Stutchbury, rang me and said, you okay? I said, yeah, I'm great. And he said, now, mate, would you mind going out and taking a look around, see what you can see and write some stuff? And I kind of tell that as a joke when I'm teasing Stutch and others, but it actually calmed me down. So as I said, that first hour I felt a bit kind of, what have I done? But then I realised, well, you've come here for a reason, so you know, get clear in your head and start reporting, right? And which is what I sort of did from then on and made it up as I went and hopefully made some kind of contribution, yeah.
You weren't staying in Hotel Ukraine, were you, when you landed?
No, I wasn't. So a lot of the Aussies were in Hotel Ukraine because it had a backdrop of Maidan, right? And so it looked really good on camera.
It does.
Funnily enough, subsequently a lot of the journos moved out of there because there was a view that that might be an inviting target for the Russian military to strike it because, you know, clearly it's a very important, potent symbol for Ukrainian identity, the Maidan Square in the middle of Kyiv where the Revolution of Dignity happened in 2014. But so a lot of Aussies moved out of there. I was up in the Hyatt where a lot of other journalists were, CNN, Sky, Wall Street Journal and others. So I went and stayed because I didn't really know how I'd get myself around. I didn't have a security detail. I was on my own completely. But I felt more comfortable being where the other journos were. So that kind of helped at least give a sense that there was a little bit of a community. Incidentally, when I was down in the bunker in the first night, first person I ran into was Sean Penn, of all people, so who was there filming a documentary. So I was like, look, I wouldn't ordinarily do this and I'm not really a kind of person that tries to take photos or selfies with stars, but I was like, look, mate, we might die down here, so how about a selfie? So which ended up going viral. It was like Aussie journo outs location of Sean Penn because no one knew where he was, so there you go. So yeah, sorry, Sean, I put you at risk, but it was a bizarre thing that you're kind of sitting there with a Hollywood actor in a hotel bunker in a country being invaded by the Russian army at the time, we didn't know how bad that they were or how weakly their army would perform, but what we believed to be the, you know, the second most powerful army in the world at that time. So it was a wild week, that first week, certainly.
So you got through, say, 72 hours a week.
Mm.
It's not actually easy to get out of there.
No, it's not. I mean, to be honest, like I was basically, even if I wanted to have gone, I was stuck. Ukraine's ambassador to Australia, Vasil Menoshenko, so he, champion fella, a good mate of mine now, but he was living in Kyiv. Now, he and I didn't know one another, but he chose to get out with his family. It took them 45 hours. So had I chosen to leave once the Russians started to invade, it's 2 days' travel. So I was kind of like, look, we're here. You know, we're stuck. You know, there was not really any great choice. So just I had to sort of hope for the best and trust that, you know, Russians don't kill journalists, right? As we know, vexed questions. So it was extremely stressful, but also a very inspiring thing to see people fighting for their freedom and everyone rallying to the cause in the way that they have and did. You know, it's certainly something that you can't, even from a distance, you can't quite understand it till you're right there alongside it, and watching that level of bravery is just extraordinary. So look, in the end I did leave, but I got taken out in a tiny Kia Sonata with wheels, you know, the size of your hand, the last car you would want to be traveling across war-torn Ukraine in, by a couple of, a married couple, Swedish medical students and their Doberman in this tiny white car. It took us 18 hours across, and we went past firing.
18 hours?
Yeah, 18 hours. Yeah.
In the car?
Yeah, and explosions and bridges being blown, all manner of things. So it was, again, pretty dicey, but, obviously got through it. But, yeah, it was that was the only way I could get out, was with the generosity of strangers. So it was, you just do what you can in that situation. And I think a lot of the people, we knew at that time millions and millions of people displaced from eastern and southern Ukraine. So I think about 12 million people at one point had to exit the country or be displaced in some way. Still many of them haven't been able to go home. So, I was just one of many,
I mean, and you've said that you've been there a few times since.
Yeah, I think I've been back 6 times over the last 18 months.
What's the conversation been like with your mum each time you go?
I guess she wasn't thrilled about me going, but it wasn't really a negotiation. I actually didn't tell many people I was going because I didn't want to have the discussion over and over with people. So I'd made the decision to go, as we discussed, and I didn't really need to be talked out of it because I wasn't going to be. So it was really, I told a few people that needed to know, I guess my family, my employer at the time. I said, look, I'm going on leave, I'm going to go do this. But otherwise, I didn't tell anyone because I didn't want people to think that I was having a nervous breakdown or something. So I let mum speak for herself, but she certainly was checking in on me a lot.
Yeah, I bet. I can't imagine that. Tell me about an experience that you went through when you were there, something that you saw to give me and my listeners a little bit of an insight into, you know, what actually is it like over there?
Well, you know, there's sort of two things. I mean, on the one hand, I'm sure you've never seen a blown up building or a dead body, right? Mm. But they're the things that you see on television, but then you forget about them, all right? But those blown up buildings don't disappear when you turn off your TV or close Instagram or however you see those images. And so being in a city where it feels like a movie set, but these are, Ukraine's a very European nation. Kyiv looks and feels like any other European capital, except there are missile strikes and sirens going off. And so trying to understand that distinction between a country at war and people getting on with the job. And so people say, well, what's happening there? So, well, cafes are full, restaurants are full. And then if a missile siren goes off, a lot of the time people ignore them now, and not because they're it's a weird thing. You just adjust so quickly. Humans are adjustment machines, and so you wouldn't think so, but you start to ignore them or adjust to the threat level. But people then just calmly go into a shelter. But then the closer you get to the front, you see more and more destruction, more and more awful scenes of, people's lives being utterly destroyed. And at the beginning of the war, I took a ride out to the Polish border with a large refugee bus, and there was obviously lots of people doing this work, but I was interested in one of the charities that were helping people get out. And I was talking to an 82-year-old lady, and she had one bag of stuff with her. So she'd come from Kharkiv, which is a city that, whilst it wasn't captured, was enormously impacted by Russian attacks and had spent 18 hours on a train laying down because everyone was basically piled in there the way they could be piled in, had one bag of stuff. I said, where are you going? She said, going to Belgium. And that was going to be an 18-hour bus ride again. And I said, well, do you know anyone over there? And she's like, no. And I was like, what are you going to do? She's like, I don't know. I'll find out when I get there. So she's like, this is my whole bag. Sorry, my whole life in one bag. And as she was crossing the border, I thought to myself, she's roughly my grandmother's age. And I thought to myself, you know, here we are 75 years later after World War II and the exact same thing's happening in the exact same place and the exact, you know, and kind of the parallel lives that my grandmother and this lady have lived, and yet here we are again. And so it is hard to understand because people think to themselves, well, it's either war, so you're picturing soldiers holding guns and, you know, conflict as you might picture it, and it is extraordinarily brutal, the conflict we're seeing, fighting that we really haven't seen World War II, but often World War I, kind of trench warfare, particularly in the East. But then people at the same time living their lives in major cities. And I sort of wrote a piece about this, trying to unpack this. And I remember there was a young girl who was serving me in a cafe, and she said, well, what are we supposed to do? Kind of like curl up into a ball and die. I mean, ultimately, yeah, your country's at war, but you've got to get on with it. You've got to put your pants on and you've got to go outside and you've got to feed yourself and you've got to go to work and you've got to try to, I suppose, contribute however you can. And they need to keep the economy going. They need to keep people moving. They need the logistics to keep fueling the war effort. So it is a strange and extraordinary thing to witness. But I think people would be surprised at how quickly it would become normal to them. It seems foreign, and yet somehow very quickly it becomes a normal thing. And that's probably the thing that struck me the most about it.
Mm. And I think about that example of the 82-year-old lady. Mm. I mean, she lived through
everything.
World War II before that. Like, it's almost like World War history II, repeating
the
itself.
The Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, the coming down of the Berlin Wall, all this hope and optimism in 91. And then Putin comes to power. The attempts to essentially meddle in Ukrainian politics, to have pro-Russian leaders, then them getting turfed out, Russia starting an invasion in Donbass in 2014, the occupation of Crimea in 2014, and then a full-scale invasion, right? So, again, when we look at our lives today, people often go, oh, geez, you know, the world's so crazy today, and you kind of think, look at the things that someone of her vintage has lived through. And it makes you realise that we don't really appreciate that truly here in Australia. And I think that's part of the reason why people can be a bit apathetic here.
And do you have plans to go back to Ukraine?
Not immediately, but we're sort of heading into the end of the fighting season now.
What does that mean?
Well, broadly speaking, it's very hard to fight in the wintertime. And so the fighting will go on, but the fighting will be broadly by artillery, missile strikes. You will see some movement of tanks because you can move tanks around in the snow, but it's very hard to move men and equipment around. And so if you have a look at what happened in the last year during the winter period, there was fighting but not a lot of movement, and I expect you probably see something similar right now at the back end now of where you can expect to have good fighting conditions, getting muddy, you know, wet, and then it'll get cold and frozen. And so that's the time you want to try to maintain your positions and you know, recalibrate yourself for some kind of spring offensive.
Can't even imagine it. Mm. You've been inspired by your time in Ukraine to write a book, which has just come out, The Sun Will Rise. Tell me about the book.
Well, so going back to the stakes of this conflict, you know, I truly believe that the Ukraine war, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is a hinge moment of history. So as I talk about looking backwards, things don't make sense till you kind of look backwards. When I was growing up, you look at things like World War II, you go, kind of, how did that happen? Why didn't the world do something about the rise of Hitler and the rise of Japanese imperialism and all these rise of dictators, Mussolini and others, Franco in Spain? Because it's really uncomfortable to do these things, and it'd be much, much more comfortable if it wasn't true. And so people try to find ways to explain away why we don't need to do something. And if we don't, the royal we, countries like Australia, but all of us who believe in free and open societies, don't do something about an aggressive dictatorship trying to conquer a democracy next door by a war of conquest, the likes of which we haven't seen in 75 years, that is going to not just be bad news for Ukraine, it's going to be bad news for the world, because The lesson to Ukraine's either going to be this was an enormous folly. It brought down Putin and it taught every other dictator that they better keep their dictatorships at home, or it's going to be a blueprint for other dictators. And so when you boil it down, what's happening in Ukraine, I see it as a classic good and evil struggle. And so my book, it's a fiction book, but it's very much rooted in fact and history of what's happened in this invasion of Ukraine and also the history between Russia and Ukraine. So it's based on things I saw, things I've read, and things that have happened. And what I've tried to do is give it a narrative story, because fundamentally humans, whilst we should think in numbers, you know, someone who's a public policy person, I believe in facts and figures and images and verifiable truths. Fundamentally as humans, the way we evolve, we have an oral history, we understand stories, we understand narrative arcs of good and evil, of come from behind victories and things like that. And so fundamentally what I try to do in this book, The Sun Will Rise, is give a story to these horrible things people have seen and try to give a sense to it, to understand these stakes and to say, this is not just a conflict going on in Eastern Europe, a long way away from Australia. This is not just a small battle between two countries that we don't really have to interact with. This is critical to Australia's future, but it's also a timeless story around a struggle for freedom from oppression. And we all fundamentally want to be free. Even people that live in dictatorships desperately want to be free. And we're lucky enough to be free in Australia, but it's a cliche, freedom's not free. The natural order of things is not democracy. If you look at human history, democracies are an aberration. We only came up with them a couple hundred years ago, and there aren't that many of them, and they're fragile, and we have to cherish them. And so I try to find a new way into this conflict, because unfortunately, the way that the world now, people get bored, they get desensitized to things, they move on from things, even if they're important. People kind of, oh, well, you know, that hasn't resolved itself. It feels like it's an intractable problem. I can't continue to engage with it. So this is a book that the story, whilst it is based in what's happening in Ukraine right now, I think it's a story that people can connect with forever, because it fundamentally is about people's want to be free, the right to live your life in peace, the right to be who you want to be without being oppressed by either a hostile neighbor or an oppressive government or dictatorship. And so, you know, I hope people can read it and connect with it, because it's a love letter to humanity. It's inspired by the heroes of Ukraine who are so bravely fighting, not just for their freedom, but for all our freedoms. Because what happens in Ukraine matters everywhere. It's not just, you know, as I said, a distant war. Australia cannot exist in a world where might is right, where large countries can squash smaller countries because they don't like them. Australia is a country of 25 million people. We occupy a continent. It's a big privilege, big responsibility. But we need a world where there are rules, and we need a world where people stick together. And that is a two-way street, right? In the past, the world has come to our aid in World War II. We were assisted by our friends and allies to stop the Japanese from taking over the Asia Pacific. And our contribution to this struggle is to help Ukrainians get their freedom. And it's a deal of the century. Then Ukrainians are not asking us to fight. They are not saying, come here and die alongside us, though maybe in some ways we should. They're saying, just give us the weapons, we'll get the job done. To knock over one of the most odious regimes, not just that we have right now around the world, in history. Putin's regime, the things that they've done in Ukraine, the rapes, the tortures, the murders. This is a war criminal atop a kleptocratic, disgraceful regime, and has completely corrupted the entire Russian state. And so they need to be defeated. Ukraine is on the way of doing that, and it's in Australia's interest for that to happen.
Now, I'm going to keep the conversation going. I'm going to switch slightly because we could keep talking about this for a long time, and then we'd be on your podcast, right?
That's right, exactly. Otherwise, we'll turn everybody off. If you really want to be bored, get into Diplomates.
It's very interesting. And as somebody who, I mean, I was in Ukraine 10 years ago now, 2013, so just before the Orange Revolution,
right.
And obviously can't go back, but stayed with family and still have a lot of family there. So it is something that that is actually also close to my heart. And I guess I only hope that one day I can actually take my daughter.
Are you family safe right now?
Misha. My daughter's called Misha back there, but it's not going to happen now.
Your family safe?
Yeah, but interestingly, some of them also went to like places, not necessarily Belgium, but like went to countries that I would never have thought that they would go. And then others decided to bunker down and stay and fight. So, but let's move on. I want to talk about personal brand. Because you clearly have one. You're an analyst, a commentator, now a war correspondent, an author.
Random.
Very, it's not my word. Maybe that was the one word for the day, random.
We can all have two, yeah.
Putting yourself out there, like it's been integral to building your career and having a face to who you are and what you do. When you hear that term personal brand, though, what comes to mind for you when you think about its role in shaping the career that you have built?
Well, it's a term that Aussies, we don't like because it sounds enormously wanky. You know, talking like about a personal brand, it sort of evokes images of Americans or athletes talking about themselves in the third person. Like, who is Misha Zielinski? But I mean, I think brand really comes down to how do you represent yourself to the world? And I think, you know, where there's so much bullshit, right? Everything feels like bullshit that people. Now, and it could be for good and bad reasons, we can come to that, but authenticity is really what people care about, right? People need to believe that you care about the things that you're saying and that you've got a genuine reason for holding the views that you do, right? So if it feels wrong to you, it's going to feel wrong to the audience. And so I haven't really tried to deliberately cultivate a brand per se, but things I do either professionally or the things that I write or the arguments that I make, I try to align them with the things that I care about. And I try to steer clear of making arguments that I think are cynical or taking positions that I think are cynical and owning up to every so often we say, look, this is an uncomfortable thing to do, but you have to do it for these reasons, explaining that as well. But so it's not something I've consciously done, I guess, but when I think about it, how I've gone about building up, I guess, my credentials in foreign policy is doing things that you care about and pursuing them on a consistent basis because brand emerges over time. Brand's not a logo. I couldn't come out and say I'm a Ukraine expert or I couldn't come out and say I'm someone that suddenly cares about democracy if I've got a record like Donald Trump. You can't just rebrand yourself. It's got to be based on some kind of truth that's central to you. And brand is closely related to trust. What's trust? It's a promise made, a promise kept 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times over a long period. And so it's that consistency of application of values is probably what I've tried to do. And when I look back at all the things that I've done, whether it's starting my podcast, whether it's writing, whether it's a Fulbright, whether it was going back to uni to study populism at London School of Economics, like those things are all streaming together. Whether it's union values, it's streaming together consistent things that line up with what I believe in and having a proven track record. So if you want to call that a brand, you can, but it's just that a proven record of the things that I say I care about rather than like a company that says we care about our customers. Do you? Does Qantas care about its customers? Even they can keep telling you that they do, but if you feel like they're not, then that's the real brand, isn't it?
I like the word credentials. I think that actually really resonated for me and perhaps, I mean, I bring up personal brand because it's something that we do as a business at the PR Hub. And we do a lot of that. And as you said, as Australians in particular, it does sound like a bit of a dirty word.
We're really uncomfortable with it.
Or feel very uncomfortable about talking about personal brands. So I quite like the word credentials. Look, you have some very strong opinions on things and you spend a lot of time. But you do it with such conviction and as you know, it's genuine and it's authentic and you spend quite a bit of time in the media. What's a practical piece of advice that you can give a business founder or somebody listening to the podcast who perhaps is like terrified of doing a media interview or getting in front of a camera? Like, how do you just get started?
Well, other than just get started, practice. So Winston Churchill would do an hour of practice for every minute of time that he spent speaking in the chamber, so they say. So I think life is about reps. The gym's about reps. Learning anything is about reps. And so the more opportunities you get either to do it with live ammunition, as we're sitting here now having this conversation, and now that's the scariest version, but even just practicing gets you a lot better at it. Training helps you as well. What are the things that give you confidence in anything, sport and life? Have you done the training? Have you, you know, if you get up on stage and hand me a guitar and I've never played guitar, it's terrifying. But if you're a great guitarist, it's fantastic because you've done all the preparatory work. And so I think people think when it comes to media that there's no practice involved, there's no training involved. Well, there's practical training you can do. There are plenty of media courses one can take. You can practice in front of small crowds. You can practice on small shows or podcasts or things of that nature. But at the same time, what I think I would say is don't dwell on your mistakes. If you go on the radio and you felt like it was a 7, it was probably a 9 because you are analyzing yourself. You say, oh, I should have said this or I stumbled here. Most people don't listen to you speaking as acutely as you are kind of observing yourself. And people get very self-conscious when they're in front of a microphone or in front of a crowd or in front of a camera. But ultimately, people aren't as focused on you as you are on yourself. So just sort of don't feel the stakes are as high, and a mistake is not going to be fatal, and be natural and people will respond to that. But practice as well.
Yeah, fantastic advice. Practice training and lots of reps. Life is about reps. Life. What did you say? Life is all about
Life's all about reps.
Reps.
It really is. It's like nothing. No one just walks out and says, "I'm a concert pianist," right? Like no one's Mozart practiced all the time, right? It's a rule. The 10,000 rule is a pretty good rule. If you practice something for 10,000 hours, you're going to become an expert in it. And you know, public speaking is probably one of those things. Now, some people are going to be gifted, and not everyone's going to be Barack Obama. Anyone's listening, I'm sorry. If you do 10,000 hours of practice, you won't be Barack Obama, but you'd be a hell of a lot better than the version of yourself as you're listening right now. And so, practicing can get you from very bad to quite good very quickly.
Yeah, no, I love that. Now we're up to the 5 and 5, which is the last section. And I know you've seen these questions. So 5 questions in 5 minutes.
I'll try to keep it to that.
Yeah, see how we go. Question number one, do you take holidays? Why? And where do you like to go?
Yes. Why? Because I'm a unionist. So I believe in people should absolutely take holidays. Like life can't be all about work. You need time to spend with, you know, what is life if it's not about doing things with people that you care about or doing the things that you care about, right? So, you know, unions, we believe in 8, 8, and 8. So 8 hours of rest, 8 hours of work, and 8 hours of recreation. And I think that's a pretty good rule. But in terms, that's your day. But in terms of a holiday, you absolutely should take your leave to recharge, because if you're just flogging yourself, you're not going to be at your best. And so you're better off performing well and then recovering. Again, training, right? Train hard, recover hard. And so I definitely do. You know, I love going to the beach. When I can, I like to get to Europe, hopefully not to a war zone. You know, I enjoy resting, reading, relaxing, and recharging yourself. I think is really critical.
Question number two. Now, I know you wear many hats, so I'm not sure about this one, but if you weren't on this career path now doing what you're doing, you could change direction and do something completely different, what would it be?
Well, my mum wasn't wise enough to get me into Formula One car racing when I was young, no go-karting. So thanks, Mum. The fantasy of being an athlete is well behind me now that I'm old. But I'll be honest, I've got a book coming out now, right? Now, hopefully, I always joke that most people can write a book. Not many people can write a good book. So we'll find out whether or not I'm in the lucky people that can write a good book. But I love writing, and I'd love to be, I guess, a writer on a more professional basis. So maybe it's that, because you know, I do a lot of things, but I do love writing, have a passion for books, words, because I think they are, you know, a really important way for us to share the things that matter to us.
Question number three, what's the best piece of career advice you've ever received?
That hard work beats talent. And now The best combination is hard working talent, right? That's probably the unbeatable combination. But even then, hard work can outwork any level of talent. So I think if you can work out where your talents lay and then work really hard at them, doubling down on that is wise. People sometimes, I think, try to spread themselves thin or try to really develop a weakness. And you don't want to have glaring weaknesses, but if you double down on your strengths and work really hard, I think that's probably the best advice. So hard work beats talent. And I think you see that all the time. There's always the talented, lazy person that you think, God, what could they have been if they'd applied themselves?
Question number four, what's one thing about you that would surprise people?
I grew up playing really nerdy strategy games. But see, given how much geopolitics we've talked about, people might not be surprised about that. But a lot of my mates just give me so much grief about the fact that I love playing Age of Empires, Risk, Civilization, games of that nature. So I'm a gamer is probably the thing that I think would surprise people, because I very much grew up playing, you know, as a rugby league playing footy head from Wollongong. But I did have that nerdy gaming streak that I loved.
Last question. Question number five. This podcast is all about influence. So I would like to know, what is your number one tip for people with influence?
Use it well. I think there's a lot of people that have influence and don't use it wisely. They use it recklessly. And there's so many examples now of like know-nothing, know-it-alls dominating our airwaves, dominating our platforms. And so if you have influence over people, use it well and don't just voice an opinion when you don't know what the hell you're talking about. The amount of Middle East experts that we have right now flooding social media because they've all put down their spreadsheets from their energy policy expertise or from their COVID expertise or whatever it is. If you are lucky enough that people listen to you, take that privilege and use it well and be very careful how you use it, because people are listening to you for a reason, and don't use your powers for evil, I would say.
That's a good one to finish the show. Thank you for joining me.
No, look, it's been a great pleasure, and love coming on a more popular podcast than mine to have a great conversation. So thanks so much for the opportunity.
We definitely covered a lot of ground. Now, before I let you go, can you tell me where can we find The Sun Will Rise?
Well, you can go to thesunwillrisebook.com, but it's available in all bookstores. You can get it on Amazon, Booktopia, wherever you buy your books. It's being distributed by Simon & Schuster, but thesunwillrisebook.com will get you your favourite retailer if that's the way you prefer to buy online.
Awesome. And if my listeners would like to connect with you, where can they do that?
At Misha Zielinski. Now, I would recommend you look at that in the show notes, but at Misha Zielinski, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, grab me wherever you want, and I try to respond to everybody that I can. I won't respond to heckling, well, unless it's friendly heckling, but I won't respond to trolling or Putinistas, but otherwise feel free to engage with me, and I'm happy to have a public conversation with you or privately.
Awesome. As Misha said, we will pop all of that stuff in the show notes so you don't have to remember it. Before we go, if you did enjoy this episode, please make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite app, give it a rating and leave a quick review so that we can reach more people like you who want to unlock their influence. And as always, if you've got a question for me, you can reach me at samantha@theprhub.com.au or you can find me on LinkedIn as well. But until next time, thanks for listening.
The Influence Unlocked podcast was presented by Samantha Dyback, CEO and founder of The PR Hub, and executive producer Andrew Menzel from Piccolo Podcasts. Want to connect with Samantha? The links to her LinkedIn and Instagram accounts are in the show notes.